So we're going to talk about malleolar ankle fractures, relatively common condition. I'll try to go over some key points that would be helpful for both junior and senior residents. We're probably already familiar with this condition. So the first thing is try to understand the classification systems. I don't think that the Log-Hansen classification has been completely disproven. There certainly have been some interesting in vivo YouTube studies looking at skateboarders and their injuries and what x-rays they actually led to, and I don't think Log-Hansen necessarily completely correlates, but it's a useful thing to know. It's certainly something you need to know for your exams. But, you know, when you're reducing these, try to think about, you know, was it an external rotation injury? And, you know, internal rotation should be a little bit part of your reduction. And but for the most part, you know, look at where the talus is. Put the talus back under the tibial plafond. You know, typically if it's displaced laterally, you want to, you know, push it over medially and so forth. So it's very important to try to get the talus somewhat reduced. Now, you may not be able to get a fibula anatomically reduced or a medial malleolus anatomically reduced when you close reduce these, but you don't want to have a subluxed talus, right? Subluxed posteriorly or laterally. I mean, you want to get the talus back in. And when you do these, you know, splints and reductions, you want a nice 3-point mold. Get those wrinkles out. You don't really want to have those lumpy, bumpy looking splints, against an ankle, especially if the patient has any potential for local tissue compromise. And that's the other thing you got to keep in mind when you're treating malleolar ankle fractures. A soft tissue envelope around the ankle is not that great. And if the patient has a couple strikes against them, maybe peripheral vascular disease, diabetes, smoker, etc., you can have a setup for a real problem, even in a splint. For getting a skin problem. So another reason why you got to get that talus under the dome, because if you don't, and you have, oftentimes it's the medial distal tibia sort of poking against the skin, you can develop some ulceration. So that's a surprise. You do not want someone else to find out when they take your splint off and realize the patient now has a hole over the medial ankle. So do your best, try to get those things reduced to prevent that problem, and especially in the patient who may have some other systemic or local issues to cause wound healing problems or breakdown in the first place. These fractures, you know, when you talk about, what's stable, what's unstable, when I was training, stress views were really big. Anytime a patient had a lateral malleolus ankle fracture that was isolated, but there was no obvious medial injury, no obvious syndesmotic injury, and we were told, well, how do you know that's not a ligamentous SCR4 or a bimal equivalent? And we were, always had to do these dynamic stress views to see if there was medial clear space widening. I think, this is a topic that's been of great interest, orthopedic trauma literature. The thought when I trained, and it was a big Tornetta thing, was that if the stress view was positive, it was technically unstable. You should probably offer surgery to the patient. If the stress exam was negative, you knew you were stable, and now you can potentially even weight bear the patient, put them in an air cast even if you like, or walking boot, or they could be functionally rehabbed sooner. So it kind of gave you some answers. There's been some studies, Ken Eagle and others, and a few other studies that sort of have shown that it's not that critical that you have to always get these stress views on everybody. So I take a kind of a sort of pragmatic approach now. I mean, I think if a patient otherwise seems like they're probably a non-operative candidate, either the patient's kind of not that interested in surgery, or they're willing to be immobilized for a period of time, you want to take a conservative approach. If the medial clear space is not widened, and they have a lateral malfracture, you put them in a cast. You put them in a cast, keep them non-weight-bearing, and, you know, you hopefully should not develop any dynamics, you know, widening of the syndesmosis in those cases. So you can do that. But I still do stress fuse. I mean, if I have a patient, lateral malfracture, I don't know if there's, you know, medial ligament injury, you know, that, you know, medial tenderness we look for, it's really not all that predictive one way or the other, whether they are tender or not, to sort of, you know, determine if they definitely have medial ligament injury. So that's not that reliable. I check it, you know, if a patient's tender or if a patient, you know, if there's a patient I really want to know an answer, and it would make a big difference, and I know they can tolerate a stress fuse, that's the other thing, they got to be able to tolerate a stress fuse in the office, then I'll get them, and you'll see we get them sometimes. External rotation stress fuse on a mortise projection and try to see if it opens. So that's enough about that. So if you have an unstable fracture, how quickly do you operate on these? You know, we do worry about wound breakdown around the ankle. These are injuries that don't necessarily have to be admitted and operated on right away, but you know, some places they do. You know, some places they say, oh, it's unstable, you know, you gotta get that fixed right away. I don't think you run into as much trouble with operating on these early as you do with bad pilon fractures. And I would also say that when these kind of, you know, come to the office and they're a couple weeks out and you fix, you know, you get them scheduled for surgery and they go through pre, you know, operative clearance by the time they get to the OR. Sometimes, I mean, you all been there. You're like, how old is this fracture? Is it 3 weeks? Oh, geez, 3 weeks old. It's older and you're struggling to get it fixed. So that's not as much of a problem if you get to them early. Maybe wound closure is a little tougher, but... and you don't know if they're about to start blistering everywhere. So there is a trade-off there. And, you know, some people operate on these early, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. And depending on where you are and what your setup is like, where you choose to practice, I mean, I think either way is probably fine, earlier or somewhat later. But you never want to get to them too late. You know, intraoperatively, whenever we do, you know, fix these fractures. If there's no obvious syndesmotic widening, you check stress fuse. You know, 3 versus 4 cortices is controversial. Whether you take the screw out or not, it's controversial. What devices you use, you know, whether or not you should get some sort of 3D type CT imaging, because there's a lot of thought that we are malreducing a lot of syndesmotic injuries. Whether or not you should do an open reduction. Even that's all controversial. There's a recent study in Journal of Orthopedic Trauma showing maybe all these little tiny, minor, imperfect reductions doesn't even matter. So, you know, it's one of these things that is just so debated in literature, but I still don't think is of major clinical consequence. Just don't miss a syndesmotic injury. And if you have one, you know, address it, get it reduced. You know, try not to malreduce it. You know, my typical routine is I usually leave them in about 10-12 weeks. I routinely take the screws out. I mean, there is some data showing that removal of the screws or auto dynamization with like self breakage of the screws leads to a little bit higher functional outcomes than if the screw stays in and does not break, therefore implying, you know, not allowing normal anatomic motion between the tibia and fibula. Patients don't like seeing broken screws. I mean, I like feeling I have more control over the situation. Therefore, I keep them non-weight-bearing until I take the screw out. I use 4 cortices because I want it to be solid. You know, with a 3-cortex screw, you can potentially auto-loosen and dynamize, which is, you know, by those surgeons who want to leave the screw in, that's considered a good thing. So I know I'm going to take it out. So I go 4 cortices. I take the screw out in most patients. So, you know, other things to keep in mind, you know, diabetics is a big question. What do you do about diabetics? You're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. So meaning that if you fix them, you have this, you know, risk of wound healing problems. If you don't fix them, you have this risk of Charcot arthropathy and destructive issues in the ankle. So, it is, you know, a tough situation to be in. You know, I generally, you know, fix them as long as they're, you know, reasonably controlled diabetics and, you know, they understand what they're up against. You know, bone healing takes twice as long. You know, you don't worry about moving the ankle, just you keep him immobilized. And you use extra fixation. Before we had locked plates, a lot of people would just take like screws in the fibular plate and put them all the way into the tibia, like multiple syndesmotic screws, just for extra fixation, essentially. So, you know, the name of the game is, you know, extra fixation, locking screws, immobilization for prolonged periods of time, you know, non-weight bearing, understanding that bone healing is slower, the bone may not be as good, and you know, wound healing is more of an issue as well. So, kind of out of my time, I think those are the key things you need to know about. Thanks.